So today I want to talk about training the wild mind. In the last couple of days, a number of people have reported to us being able to connect with the practice to a certain extent. But especially those who arrived for the second half, people are noticing the challenges of sitting, of walking day in, day out, with a mind that's what the Buddha called untamed. And I really like that word because it's very evocative. A being that is untamed and a mind that is untamed is wild, out of control, unpredictable, intractable, and sometimes even dangerous. You know, it can harm us. And whether we've just arrived last week or we've been here for quite a while, we're bound to encounter the mind that is untamed. It's inevitable. And in practice, we really see vividly how the mind can go all over the place, sometimes to dangerous places. And we can't control it, can we? How nice that would be. A few people have reported really noticing how they're sitting, minding their own business, just cultivating loving kindness, and then all of a sudden, the kilesa come in and take over the mind stream. And how surprising that can be, how uncontrollable. Where did this come from? This is the untamed mind. And we talk about training the mind and taming the mind. And it's just such a lovely metaphor, because when we train and tame a domestic animal like a horse, or particularly a wild animal, it's sometimes called gentling. And it's a process that can take many years. Even an animal that's born into domesticity can take years to come into full training. I was looking online just out of curiosity to see, for example, how long it takes to train a good horse. And in Austria, there's the Spanish riding school, and the Lipizzaners there are trained for 6 years before they're ready for performances, 6 years of just training. And that's a domestic horse. That's not the mind. With the mind, this taming isn't so different. It's just that it takes much, much longer than 6 years. Sometimes, unless people's paramis are really ripe. But for most of us, this is the work of a lifetime or lifetimes. And often in the suttas, the Buddha speaks of this metaphor of taming and training, saying that taming the mind is like training a good horse or a war elephant. And the Buddha had come from a warrior caste. So a war elephant, this is an incredibly valuable thing that only a king would have. And such a being needs to be trained with great care and great precision, just like the mind. So when we train this mind, we're very gradually making it more docile, more easily directed, and removing or replacing wild, unruly habits that we all come to practice with pliability, flexibility, non-resistance, and non-clinging. In the first retreat, I spoke a little bit about how metta bhavana is a process of purification and purification of unwholesome mind states. This is that training. The other day, Sayadaw spoke about the 10 kilesa. This is what gets purified. These states where the untrained, untamed mind tends to go. Greed, hatred, aversion, delusion, conceit, wrong views, doubt, torpor, restlessness, shamelessness, and recklessness. These 10 kilesas. And also, and more simply, as I mentioned in that first retreat, the hindrances, the 5 hindrances. Sense desire, ill will, drowsiness and dullness, recklessness and remorse, and doubt. Again, you see some overlap there. Is there anyone here who has not experienced these states? We all have, right? I mean, this is what we come to practice and what we see. And for those of you who have just arrived in the last week, at this point in the retreat, it's pretty universal that they be arising. Sometimes quite strongly. And even, as that person mentioned, even for those who've been here for some time, they can arise kind of out of nowhere as one of those little surprises that can happen in the practice. Here's how the Buddha describes someone who's beset by the hindrances. And this comes from the Sanda Sutta, which is in the Anguttara Nikaya. Sanda, who is a person he's talking to, Sanda, practice the absorption of a thoroughbred horse, not the absorption of an unbroken colt. And how is an unbroken colt absorbed? I love this. An unbroken colt tied to the feeding trough is absorbed with the thought, barley grain, barley grain. Why is that? Because as he is tied to the feeding trough, the thought does not occur to him. I wonder what task the trainer will have me do today. What should I do in response? No, tied to the feeding trough, he is simply absorbed with the thought, barley grain, barley grain. In the same way, there are cases where an unbroken colt of a person, having gone to the wilderness, to the foot of a tree, or to an empty dwelling, dwells with his awareness overcome by sensual passion, obsessed with sensual passion. Making that sensual passion the focal point, he absorbs himself with it, besorbs, resorbs, and supersorbs himself with it. He dwells with his awareness overcome by ill will, sloth and drowsiness, restlessness and remorse, doubt. He is absorbed, dependent on this world, or whatever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, sought after, or pondered by the intellect. This is how an unbroken cult of a man is absorbed. I chuckled when I first read that, because I totally relate to being tied to the feed trough and thinking, barley grain, barley grain. Maybe we're not eating barley, but, you know. When we sit here on retreat, it's these six cords of the sense doors that tie us to this feed trough. And fortunately, the fact that this is happening is not a personal failing. These arise in accord with nature and in accord with conditions and our own personal karma. Normally, in everyday life, we don't notice this so much. It just seems so normal. But on retreat, when we try to focus the mind on the cultivation of loving kindness, we get to see the entire show in vivid, vivid detail. And these hindrances in particular can make mountains out of molehills, as we say in English. You know, they can take something that's tiny and very unimportant and turn it into a life crisis. And it often starts out, one of these little fits, often starts out with some unnoticed bit of sense contact that's either pleasant or unpleasant. A sight, a smell, a sound, a taste, a sensation, a thought. And we're off in an eye blink, just like that. And because we're doing metta bhavana, which is a concentration practice, rather than vipassana bhavana, often this can happen because we're not being mindful of thinking as it's happening. And so if there's something that we have the tendency to get caught in and it comes up strongly, we can get these huge little storms, these hindrance attacks. Sometimes hindrance attacks can come as a solo hindrance attack. Maybe there's greed, irritation, doubt. And sometimes they come in little crowds. And they're very, very unpleasant, of course, this experience of being caught in them. And of course, also, they are completely unwholesome. The Buddha called them a heap of the unwholesome. And even though they are unpleasant, unwholesome, it's essential that we remember that if they're arising, it may not be because we're doing anything wrong. They're universal aspects of human experience. They're the tendency of the unawake mind that we come here to purify. And the practice really takes a new turn when we can relax around these difficulties and learn from them and just continue to patiently train the mind. When we bring in a wild horse and try to gentle it, we don't beat it up for being wild. It's just wild. That's the nature of the horse. That said, these experiences can be such a big challenge in the metta practice, overwhelming the mind and preventing us from either developing metta or concentration. And sometimes it can seem like, oh, I just spun on that for the whole afternoon. What a waste of time. It's not a waste of time. That's the judgment, of course. But these mind states are what prevent and hinder the arising of concentration and the development of metta. And in the context of a retreat like this, where we're cultivating metta bhavana, we work with them in a different way than we do in the vipassana practice. In the vipassana practice, when any of them arise, they're just another mind state to be clearly observed as best as we can. So the instruction is to dive in, to observe them as keenly and clearly as you can, with mindfulness, with investigation, with wise attention, in order to discern the characteristics of the hindrances, both in terms of their specific experiential qualities and their general characteristics. That being the fact that they are, all of them, impersonal, unsatisfactory, and not self. So that's the vipassana approach in a nutshell. But when we're doing metta bhavana, we don't do any of that. The instruction is that as soon as we notice the mind has gone off, we simply and very gently bring it back to the cultivation of loving kindness, like that horse. That's all. It's no more complicated than that. Just come back, start again. Well, happy, peaceful. Well, happy, peaceful. Whatever your phrase is. Always inclining the mind and heart to the metta and away from the hindrances. And in either case, whether we're doing metta bhavana or vipassana bhavana, the instruction is not to analyze the hindrance. Because we can't think our way out of hindrance attacks at all. That just amplifies them. So sometimes people with psychological training or inclination can find this approach unfamiliar and very confronting. Counterintuitive, actually. But practice is never about the stories these hindrances are spinning. This isn't the place for dwelling on that or understanding that or figuring that out. The hindrances are just ephemeral mind states, nothing more than that. Any story we tell about them and our relationship with them is extra. And if we take them too seriously, that feeds one of two things. First being the identification with the hindrance. Oh, this is my fear problem, or this is my anxiety problem, or my loneliness problem, or whatever. We all have those stories. And it also feeds the habit of taking that identity we have around, I am the person who has this fear, taking the identity as something that's real, something that's substantial, and something that's enduring. So we just set all of that aside. Continue to cultivate the loving kindness. And in all cases, no matter what is arising, and no matter what practice we are doing, sense restraint is our friend, regardless of the hindrance that's arising. Sense restraint is incredibly important, particularly early in a retreat, but also much of the time when we're here practicing. We're used to distracting ourselves with sense objects of all kinds. We distract ourselves with seeing, with hearing, you know, music, sights, with food, with tasting, with mind contact, all that stuff that happens on our mobile devices. But this kind of distraction on retreat is the main place where we lose the continuity of the cultivation of loving kindness, and where we lose the continuity of the developing the concentration. So, for example, if you have the habit at the end of lunch of sitting there in the dining room with your cup of tea and gazing around, I'm just going to relax here. And we're not paying attention to what's happening in here. That's like spending all morning blowing up a balloon and then putting a pin in it. Boom, there goes the cultivation of the concentration. There goes the continuity of the metta. Or if we, when we leave the meditation hall and we're going here and there from here to our room or to the dining room and we have the habit of looking around, the same thing can happen. And we're not going to stand here and be like police. It's your retreat. But just so you know, if you are really prone to gazing here and there and getting distracted by sense contact, not restraining the sense doors, just so you know, that this actually prolongs the length of time that it takes for the metta and the concentration to gain momentum. So it can be very, very frustrating. It's also a place for compassion, because so far as sense contact is concerned, we really potentially have a fight on our hands because we're so addicted to it. That wild mind has strong habits and will really rebel if we're too forceful with this sense restraint. So we have to be gentle. Here's what it says in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is a lovely metaphor. It says, the elephant tamer, driving a great post into the ground, ties the forest elephant to it so as to subdue his forest ways and to accustom him to human ways, and addresses him with such words as are gentle, pleasing to the ear, affectionate, going to the heart. So this forest elephant that's being tamed is our mind, and we drive a great post into the ground. But then there's that second part of affection, gentleness, kindness. I really like this metaphor because the Buddha talks about the forest elephant not being used to being out of the forest. And it helps us to understand our minds are the same way. When the hindrances are strong, we may actually want to follow them. This is like the forest elephant wanting to go back to the forest. And it's vital when we're training the mind to exercise resolution. And to know that if a hindrance has arisen, it's just that elephant not used to human company. It's that wild animal of the mind, not used to restraint, not used to not going wherever it wants. If we react to that with irritation or to aversion, the practice will turn into a big struggle. And that actually amplifies the hindrance. So the challenge of balance is really to stand our ground in sense contact and to not follow the pull gently but firmly. So, for example, say you have an attack of ill will. You're sitting here, you've been meditating, it's quiet, and then somebody does something completely irritating. And they keep doing it. And every time they do it, or when you think of how selfish you judge them to be for doing it, that irritation turns to anger. Maybe the anger even turns to rage. This can happen. And instead of looking at the anger, as we do in a Vipassana retreat, the instruction is to simply put the dosa to the side and continue to radiate loving kindness to whomever you have chosen. Or if you can't get traction with that person, to go where it's easy. In all cases, no matter which hindrance has arisen, it helps to reflect briefly on the negative consequences of that. So if you can't pull the mind back, force doesn't work. But to gently remind yourself of how painful this is, gently remind yourself, say, of this rage, how dangerous it is. And gently remind yourself why you really don't want to follow that deeply, ultimately, even though on the surface there is this strong pull. Each of the hindrances has a specific antidote. And I don't want to go into that with any depth today. That could be a whole talk. But just to remind you, most of you are already very familiar with this. So when there's strong greed, whether it's sensual lust for another person, or greed for some sense object, such as lunch, or some food object. What undoes that, what goes against the grain of that, can be very specifically to take a moment to reflect about the asubha or unbeautiful aspect of that person or that object. So with another person, you can go through the 32 parts of the bodies and just kind of imagine dissecting hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, all of these things. Or with food, we can really be quite taken by wanting food. It's our main entertainment on retreat. But imagine what happens to that food when you put it in the body. How delicious it is, and then what happens to it? Yeah, that can undercut the greed quite a bit. It's just sustenance. With dosa, with metta practice in particular, irritation, ill will, fear, metta is said to be the natural antidote. And particularly if you are having a dosa attack that's directed to yourself, it can be very, very helpful to really take a moment to reflect on something good you've done. It doesn't have to be huge. You don't have to have won the Nobel Prize. But just some good thing, some small good thing. We all do many good things. And the fact that you've just come here and are spending this time doing what you're doing is very good. It's deeply good. So to take a moment to acknowledge that, it inclines the mind to goodness, which is the causal, the primary proximate cause of loving kindness to arise. And also for any being for whom you have a little bit of irritation. Everybody has some good points, much as we sometimes don't want to acknowledge that. So then the third hindrance, sleepiness and mental torpor. The thing here with this hindrance is to remember that energy begets energy. It's counterintuitive. But if we're sliding into sleepiness or mental torpor, to bring a little more energy into the mind and body. This is why that Brahma Vihara chant is very good in the evening, because it's very much of a wake-up chant. To sit up straight. Sometimes it helps to open the eyes, to look at a source of bright light. The texts say, pull your earlobes. This actually can be very helpful. For the opposite of sleepiness, for restlessness, it's just the opposite. We sit still. We don't feed it by moving all the time or looking around all the time. Or if it's mental restlessness, we do the best that we can to keep the mind fixed to a single point, to keep bringing it back to the loving kindness, even if it feels mechanical. And then for doubt, doubt can be really, really difficult, because partly because we believe it so easily, and partly because it really undercuts the energy for practice. And for doubt, the remedy spoken of in the texts is careful attention. And basically in this context, it means to pay attention to whatever is arising in a way that feeds the wholesome, that feeds brightness. And to be careful about the stories we follow and how we're following them. So the kilesa, the hindrances, there are general and specific ways of working with all of them. And in addition to these, it's really useful to know the big picture. And in this case, that being the development, opening, and training of the heart that we're doing here as a gradual process, really relies on all four of the Brahma Viharas, these divine abodes that we've been chanting about every night. I won't go into detail about them today, except to say, as you know very well right now, metta, the very first of them, is the gentle, friendly, and benevolent wish for the welfare and benefit of living beings. Karuna, compassion, is that same state of heart and mind that inclines to the suffering of living beings. Mudita, the third Brahma-vihara, is metta that inclines to the good fortune of living beings. And the last Brahma-vihara, upeka, equanimity, is a balance of mind and heart that doesn't hold any single being whatsoever as higher, as better, or as more deserving of kindness than any other. This is that breaking down of the barriers that we speak about in the loving kindness practice. In the Majjhima Nikaya, there are a couple of suttas laying out the direct teachings that the Buddha gave his son, Rahula. Sayadaw mentioned very briefly at the beginning of his talk yesterday, he mentioned Rahula. And he ordained as a seven-year-old, quite a young child. And these instructions were given to him soon after he became a novice. So, seven-year-old kid. So part of the instruction the Buddha gave his son is this. And I really appreciate it for its practicality and the fact that it acknowledges these kilesa that can come up for us in life as we relate to other beings. The Buddha said, "Develop the contemplation of goodwill. For when you develop the contemplation of goodwill, ill will be abandoned. Develop the contemplation of compassion. For when you develop the contemplation of compassion, cruelty will be abandoned. Develop the contemplation of empathetic joy. For when you develop the meditation of empathetic joy, resentment and discontent will be abandoned. And develop the contemplation on equanimity. For when you develop the meditation on equanimity, irritation will be abandoned." So in this passage, really the four Brahma-viharas are described as a way to help free the mind from some of the most toxic mind states that we're prone to, really. Cruelty, resentment, chronic irritation. But it's not a contemplation that's done in any systematic way. And the thing I find, though, about this passage that's so interesting and that I want to highlight is that verb, abandon. Because in the metta practice, we generally place much more emphasis on developing. But it's with this development that that abandoning comes. And it's an essential thing to understand because they're causally linked. If we do one, the other will naturally follow. And I like that word abandon because in English anyway, it has a particular connotation. That being to leave something behind without ever intending to return. Like abandoning an old car by the side of the road. And it's putting aside. And the entire focus of this metta practice is done in the service of this putting aside. But because we have these wild minds and we're wild animals in training, it's not so easy as simply putting it down and walking away. In many Dharma communities, Dharma circles, the phrase letting go has become an activity that we're demanded to do actively. You have to just let go. Just let go of it. It's just a mind state. Or whatever, you know. But this demand to just let go misunderstands the process. It cannot and must not be forced. You can't just let go by force. This is what amplifies that hindrance or whatever it is. True relinquishment, true abandoning is not an act of will. Because, as I said, when the mind is caught in some kilesa or another, you can't just let go. So if we apply that in this way, it can be a source of two things, either frustration. We try, and we just can't let go. Or it can be a source of shallow intellectualization, where we can't find a kind of false refuge in retreating to a heady thinking about something, rather than to the direct, immediate, and bare experience of whatever it is. So something happens, we don't like it. We say to ourselves, oh yeah, this is arising, but I'm okay with that. You know, we jump to, I'll let that go. I can let that go. There's this eagerness to try to let it go, but we're denying the real experience, which is kind of bubbling under there, under the surface of that spiritual bypassing. So if you find you're saying to yourself, oh, this is so unwholesome, I have to let it go, that's actually resistance. And anything we resist gets stronger. So I find for myself a way of describing the process that's more helpful than the phrase letting go is letting be. It's a complete surrender to the way things are, right here and right now, whether we like it or not. This no longer puts up any resistance to whatever is arising. There's no longer any stopping of the flow of experience. This is how it is, and we acknowledge that. So again, as I said before, just now, in the context of working with the hindrances, once we acknowledge a hindrance is present and can be with that without resisting it, that's what allows us to put whatever it is in the background while continuing to cultivate the loving kindness. We have to accept it before we can put it aside. And then we can let it be there in the background and more or less ignore it. But we're not suppressing it because we've acknowledged it. There it is. We've admitted to ourselves that we're full of rage or doubt or greed or whatever it is. And in this way, we don't feed it with annoyance, with resistance, with analyzing it. And again, and just as I said before, we also don't go into the middle of it. We simply and very gently continue to cultivate and develop the metta, drawing the mind away from the dosa, or whatever it is, a 1,000 times, 100,000 times, however long it takes, may I be well, happy, and peaceful anyway. May I be well, happy, and peaceful. May I be well, happy, and peaceful. Just keep practicing. And in the metta practice, we work with these hindrances and unwholesome mind states in this way, really in order to care, not in order to understand or figure out. And when we persist in doing this, and when we're successful in doing this, eventually the metta gains momentum. And whatever it is replaced by the force of that momentum. And this is, in fact, that abandoning. The mind drops whatever it is. It drops that like a burning coal. It's like, whoa. And this can be gradual, or a couple of you have really mentioned how surprising it can be. It can be very sudden. It's like this mind state that's been so persistent and so strong, suddenly it just vanishes. And I know I've told this story, but for me, it's so alive decades later. One of the reasons I'm here doing what I'm doing with my life is because the very first morning of the first complete day of my very first Vipassana retreat, I was beset by a huge, huge anger attack. It was rage, actually. I was really angry and enraged at a friend with whom I'd come to the retreat, because she'd done something thoughtless, and I thought she was being a hypocrite, and the mind was just latched onto this, and it built into this incredible rage. After a while, the Vipassana wasn't getting any traction at all, so I decided to do loving kindness. May we be well, happy, and peaceful. I was using a different phrase, but basically that was the intent. And I just was doing walking meditation. Every time her socks went by, boom, there it came again. You know, didn't take much. After about 45 minutes of this, as I was repeating the phrase, very suddenly it just broke like a pane of glass. It just shattered. This rage just, it was gone. And there was this upwelling from the heart of compassion for myself, for her, for everybody in the room. It was overwhelming, actually. I was so shocked. In my entire life, nothing like this had ever happened. I can be quite prone to anger. Usually it's towards inanimate objects, but sometimes people. And I thought, oh, the Buddha was really on to something. So, you know, decades later, I'm still training the mind. It's quite an elephant, I have to say. But so just have faith as much as you can. Just keep going. You never know if the next moment is when that restlessness turns into calm, when that anger turns into metta. And just in general, we can use these Brahmaviharas as the Buddha suggested to Rahula. So as a tool to specifically abandon ill will with metta, cruelty with karuna, compassion, resentment or envy or jealousy with mudita, or irritation with upekkha. And we can use each of these Brahmaviharas as in that general way to address our own particular habitual weakness, our Achilles heel, wherever it is. You all know for yourself where you tend to go, which of those hindrances you tend to be most prone to. For example, if you know you're prone to envy, or resentment. Mudita is your tool. If you're prone to dosa, it's metta, and so on. But in addition to this kind of general use of these Brahma Viharas, they're actually far more than just a tool for giving us relief from a few toxic mind states. Because when we use them in a systematic way, that can be the basis for a profound deepening of wisdom, and as the footing for awakening itself. So in another text from the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha is describing using the four Brahma Viharas as a systematic means of developing concentration, and then with that as a basis, switching to liberating insight practice. So first developing what he calls the mind release, chaito vimutti, the mind release of loving kindness. Then when one is successful with that, going on to karuna, the mind release of compassion. When you're successful with that, going on to the mind release of mudita, empathetic joy. Success with that, going on to equanimity. And then having pursued, handed the reins and taken these as a basis, we train ourselves in concentration. And once the jhanas, the different states of concentration, are developed, then switching to vipassana. So using each of these Brahma Viharas as a step to deepen the mind's ability to stay focused and quiet and calm. To take this up systematically and pursue it to its end completely gentles the mind, so it's no longer obsessed by what once obsessed it. And going back to that sutta where it talks about the unbroken colt, the Sanda Sutta, the Buddha, of course, doesn't just stay with the unbroken colt. He tells us what the trained mind does. He says, "And how is a thoroughbred absorbed? An excellent thoroughbred horse tied to the feeding trough is not absorbed with the thought, barley grain, barley grain." Why is that? Because as he is tied to the feeding trough, the thought occurs to him, I wonder what task the trainer will have me do today. What should I do in response? Tied to that feeding trough, he is not absorbed with the thought, barley grain, barley grain. In the same way, an excellent thoroughbred of a person, having gone to the wilderness, to the foot of a tree, or to an empty dwelling, dwells with awareness, not overcome by sensual pleasure, not obsessed with sensual pleasure. He dwells with his awareness not overcome by ill will, by sloth or drowsiness, by restlessness, by doubt. Not caught in these hindrances, in other words. And when we've tamed the mind like this, all manner of annoyances can be tolerated with balance, with ease. And the deepening of the practice is no longer hindered by all our old reactive habits that made the mind wild and out of control. There comes a place of choice when we've tamed the mind to this extent, so that when we see the arising of an unwholesome thought, there is a moment of choice. We can choose to follow it or not. And I really love some of the verses of the first disciples of the Buddha, the Theragata and the Theragata, the verses of the first Buddhist monks and the first Buddhist nuns. And some of the verses of the first Buddhist nuns are quite entertaining. Some of the long ones are conversations between the bhikkhuni, who's sitting there minding her own business, and Mara, who comes to bother her and to try to distract her. And he's always singing some song like self-doubt or lust or, you know, why are you sitting there under the tree? You're so beautiful. Why don't you come with me? Or, you know, some version of something, one of these hindrances. And always at the end of the verse, there's the nun says, I see you, Mara. And there are a couple of them that I really like. It's, Mara, you are done. You're finished. It's her song of awakening that says, yeah, thanks for sharing. But I'm not going to follow you. And at the end of that sutta where the Buddha is talking about the excellent thoroughbred or the unbroken colt, he says, the ultimate result of the mind that's tamed to this extent, he says, such a one is able to endure heat, cold, hunger, thirst, the touch of mosquitoes, gadflies, wind, sun, creeping things, abusive language, unwelcome modes of speech. He's grown to bear bodily feelings, which as they arise are painful, acute, sharp, severe, wretched, miserable, and even deadly. So not only is there tolerance, there's boundless compassion and guidance, balance in the face of whatever is arising, whether it's physical pain or something somebody says to us or that annoying mosquito, you know, that we would normally be kind of swatting. It's this very gradual training that takes this wild mind and turns it into a mind like that. Into a mind like the Buddha's that Sayadaw was talking about yesterday in that story about Angulimala, where he can be, you know, faced with somebody who's trying to kill him and just radiating compassion. And as it says at the end of that sutta about the unbroken colt, it says, purified of all the impurities of greed, hatred, and delusion, he is worthy of gifts, worthy of offerings, worthy of respect. And I almost choke up with this, an unsurpassed field of merit for the world. Of course, this doesn't happen overnight or even in a month. But please don't be discouraged by the length of time it takes or how many lifetimes you think you need. There is this long view that gives perspective. But even if we don't morph into Buddhas tomorrow or in the next week or so, please know that even a little metta practice bears fruit. And it really gives noticeable results in terms of how we relate to the world and how we relate to people in it. We hear stories like this all the time of people going out into the world after sitting and being so surprised. It's like, wow, the metta kept going. And people were so friendly. Or they go home and they're shocked to find they have a completely different relationship to some different difficult person that maybe here they couldn't even get traction with. But when faced with that person in real life, there's this compassion How did that happen? Well, moment after moment after moment, may I be well, happy, and peaceful. May my difficult person be well, happy, and peaceful. So if we have the patience to just keep going, there is a transformation that happens. And then no matter what arises in the world, there is that balance. I want to close with a quote by Sele Dipankara, who has a center up in Pienuluin. She's quite a wonderful Burmese nun who's got amazing concentration skills and an amazing practice. She's a very good concentration Anapana teacher. She says, with metta, everything is beautiful. But we need to keep trying and training again and again on metta, on how to practice metta. And when you think of everything with metta, everything will be perfect. So, may the wild animals of our minds be tamed so that we can experience this beautiful perfection of metta, karuna, mudita, upeka. Thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.